Consumer Affairs. And I'd like to, or will, open a work session on House Bill 2091. And Janet, can you quickly...
Yes, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2091 transferred certain contested case hearings on matters other than those concerning a claim from the Office of Administrative Hearings to the Workers' Compensation Board. We had last week a dash one amendment and carried the bill over today for the dash two amendment, and that changes the word. Remember, there was a shall to may change on page 31, and that is now on line 17 of the amendment. And what that does is give the Workers' Compensation Board discretion to defer action instead of requiring deferral of action until the director takes action. So this gives the Workers' Compensation Board some additional discretion. Mr. Chair, the provisions of 2091 have been reviewed and approved by the Management Labor Advisory Committee, MLAC, and the Office of Regulatory Streamlining. The bill maintains the policy of having an independent panel for the review of agency decisions, but it's the Workers' Compensation Board instead of the Office of Administrative Hearings. And this is a small number of claims compared to the total number of workers' compensation claims. Mr. Chair, John Schultz is here to talk about the proposed amendment, and to address the fiscal impact because we do not have an official fiscal impact statement from the Legislative Fiscal Office this morning.
Thank you, Janet. And who is it this year?
John Schultz.
Could I have John Schultz come up, please? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here in front of you today. My name is John Schultz. I'm the administrator for the Workers' Compensation Division. I'm here in support of HB 2091 and the proposed Dash 2 amendments. I was in front of you last Wednesday and talked about this bill. We made a one-word change in the bill, as the committee administrator indicated, a shall to a may, which does provide the Workers' Compensation Board administrative law judge with more discretion about how to proceed in a contested case situation where there is a matter pending in front of the director as well as a matter pending in front of the board. And we think this is a very good change. It's the right thing to do from the Workers' Compensation Division perspective. So we would recommend moving the dash to amendments, Mr. Chair. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that I can from the committee.
Okay. On the physical impact.
Mr. Chair, as you know, we don't, I haven't seen the fiscal from Legislative Fiscal Office, but we have done some estimation about the impact. We believe there's going to be savings for the Workers' Compensation Division in this bill. It's not a lot, but we're estimating somewhere in the neighborhood of probably about $200,000 to $250,000 per biennium would be saved. My understanding is there's no impact on the Workers' Compensation Board. As the committee administrator indicated, this is a small number of contested cases, and the board should be able to absorb these cases in their current workload. And it's also my understanding that there was no anticipated impact at the Office of Administrative Hearing either.
Thank you, John. And Janet, there was no referral to on attached.
No, Mr. Chair, the Legislative Fiscal staff said that there was not a meet reason for it to come down to the Ways and Means Committee because it would be a very small effect on the agency's budgets. And the other thing is that it is anticipated in the governor's budget, so the agencies have been talking about it when they submitted their budgets.
Thank you.
And it's not any general fund.
Is there any questions? Don? I don't see any. I think they've got all the answers then. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I would Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2091.
Representative Kitts moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2091. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 2091 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2091 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Shelford.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Consent calendar, or no? Probably better not.
Better explain it.
Yeah, better explain it.
Representative Schaffler is a great explainer.
Do I have a volunteer?
I'll volunteer.
Okay.
With that great endorsement, how could I not?
All right. Representative Schaffler will carry the bill on the floor. Okay, and well, I'm going to close the work session. We will take up 2461 later in the meeting. We're waiting on some amendments. And open a hearing on House Bill 2033. And Janet, can you give us a rundown on it?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2033 is the first of two bills that we have this morning that were at the introduced at the request of the state treasurer. And you have the 2033-1 amendments at your place, and that is what the staff measure summary is summarizing, is the dash 1 amendments. Mr. Chair, the dash 1 amendments in the bill would allow financial institutions that accept deposits of public funds of under $100,000, which is the level of coverage of deposit insurance, to do so without entering into collateralization agreements that are required under current law. And the bill clarifies that credit unions are not required to enter into collateralization agreements to accept deposits of public funds because they cannot accept public funds over their insurance, the insured level. There's some other technical corrections that are made in the bill. And these changes, the ones that regard custodian banks, time deposits, and negotiable CDs, are intended to clarify current practice, so there's really no change in practice. The main part of the bill is the clarifying when banks and credit unions do not have to have collateralization agreements. And that can be seen in on the dash 1 amendments, it's lines 13 to 20. That is a new section, the sub 3 there.
Okay. Sure. Thank you, Janet. Can I have Darren Bond, please? Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. House Bill 2033 makes a number of technical changes to ORS Chapter 295. While many of the changes deal with organization of the statutes, I'll address the substantive changes. The biggest change in the bill is found in Section 3.3. The language corrects an existing inconsistency. As a matter of prudent fiscal management, the state requires financial institutions that accept public funds deposits in excess of $100,000 or the insured amount to enter into collateralization agreements with the treasurer and a custodian bank. The purpose of these agreements is to provide protection against the loss of funds in the event of a default on the part of a financial institution. However, current law also requires that financial institutions that hold deposits less than the $100,000 insured amount also enter into these agreements. Since these smaller deposits are completely insured, entering into the agreements is unnecessary and creates unnecessary costs and inefficiencies on the part of the institution and the treasurer's office. This change will allow for institutions holding deposits under insured amounts to do so without entering into these unnecessary agreements. Section 4 of the bill takes language currently found in ORS 295.005 sub 6 and clarifies it. It also eliminates a conflict between Chapters 294 and Chapters 295. This conflict relates to local government investment and time deposits. In Chapter 294, time deposits are included in the list of authorized investments, while in Chapter 295, authorized investments are excluded from the protections of that chapter. In other areas in 295, it in fact does speak to time deposits. This change will clarify that and will allow that time deposits of local governments are protected by the protections provided in ORS Chapter 295. This is found in paragraph 2 of that section. In Section 4.1, two clarifications are made. The first in subsection B is of the request of the Department of Justice. It reflects how the investment dollars flow through the state's custodian bank. The custodian typically plays more of an administrative role than an investment one, and this change simply clarifies that. The second in subsection C clarifies that negotiable certificates of deposit are not subject to the chapter. Negotiable CDs are actively traded money market instruments and are generally issued by large money center banks and are often in a portfolio like the Oregon Short-Term Fund. Because of the similarity in names, it's important to clarify the distinction between negotiable and standard certificates of deposit. We've reviewed the amendment from the banking industry and believe that it clarifies our intent in bringing you this bill and are comfortable with that language. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Darren. Questions? Essentially what this does is if they have less than $100,000 in deposits and it's covered by FDIC or whatever the insuring agency is, then it's removed from that requiring collateral to guarantee the deposit.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Martinez. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association to lend our support for the Treasurer's Bill 2033. This bill did have a full hearing and work session in the Revenue Committee prior to coming to the Business Committee. So I would just like to introduce Ken Sherman, the OBA counsel, to talk a little bit about the amendments that we are proposing.
Ken?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman. I'm counsel for the Oregon Bankers Association, and we offer these amendments to House Bill 2033 to clear up some confusion resulting from the passage by the 2003 legislature of Senate Bill 331, which amended ORS 294-035 to add credit union deposit accounts to the list of permissible investments for public funds. It amended 295.05 to include credit unions within the definition of depository bank and pool manager, and it amended 295.025 to provide that public officials could not deposit into any one depository bank that is a credit union or a federal credit union an aggregate sum in excess of $100,000. As to depository banks, including credit unions, Senate Bill 331 left in ORS 295.05 sub 4 the provision that a institution couldn't be a depository bank unless it entered into this agreement to pledge securities. With respect to credit unions, this requirement makes no sense because under 295.025, as amended by Senate Bill 331, credit unions couldn't take public funds deposits over that $100,000 limit, and no institution is required to pledge securities to cover deposits that are covered by deposit insurance. So as to credit unions, that provision made no sense. Section 3, sub 3 of House Bill 2033 would delete this pledging requirement for all institutions that take public funds only up to their insurance limits, and the Oregon Bankers Association is supportive of that amendment. However, in our view, the amendment by itself does not eliminate the confusion over the pledging issue and related issues, and we believe that the proposed amendments that are now the Dash 1 amendments, or the proposed amendments in 2033 further muddied those waters. Subsection 2 of Section 3 of the bill, beginning on line 37 on page 3, says that an institution described therein, which would include a credit union, cannot be a depository bank unless it certifies to the state treasurer that it will furnish reports required under ORS 714-075 and, except as provided in sub 3, enters into a written agreement with a state treasurer and a custodian pledging securities and so forth. With respect to that first part, it is inappropriate, in our opinion, to impose this requirement on credit unions, this requirement that they furnish reports under ORS 714-075, because that statute is part of the Bank Act. It has nothing to do with credit unions. The Bank Act is ORS 706 through 716. Credit unions are governed by Chapter 723, and they're not subject to 714-075, so it makes no sense for that statute to require them to make those reports under a provision of the Bank Act. With respect to subparagraph B, we believe it is confusing and inappropriate to refer to state and federal credit unions in this subsection because under the provisions of 295.025, as I've already said, credit unions are not permitted to take public funds deposits over their insurance limits of $100,000. It makes no sense to have them required to comply with a statute where that would never apply to them because they would never, under this other statute, be taking deposits over that limit. The Dash 1 amendments are intended to eliminate these sources of confusion by revising Sub 2 of Section 3 to make its provisions applicable only to insured institutions and trust companies, and those are code words defined in the Bank Act to mean banks and trust companies, which are subject to 714-075, the reporting statute, and to not make them applicable to credit unions, which aren't subject to those requirements. The Dash 1 amendments also call for eliminating references to credit unions from subsection 4 of section 3 of House Bill 2033, which permits a pool manager. Credit unions are permitted to be pool managers under 295.005, but once again, it makes no sense to require a credit union to comply with 714.075, the reporting requirement. Thus, the amendments would amend subsection 4 to eliminate its reference to credit unions. So, in a one-sentence summary, we believe that these amendments simply clean up some inadvertent confusion that was left in the law as a result of the 2003 legislation, and we support the Dash 1 amendments, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Chairman, now that it's clear as mud, I think these amendments were worked out with the State Treasurer's Office, Mr. Bond, their Assistant Attorney General. They are supportive, and we know of nobody objecting to these amendments.
Thank you. So any questions? Representative Schaffler.
I'm all for clearing up any confusion in statute. That's all I had to say.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Pam Levitt, please.
That's a lot.
Morning, Pam.
Good morning, everybody. I'm, for the record, Pam Levitt with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I'm not going to go through the bill because you had some wonderful people who already testified. You have my written testimony. We're very pleased that the Treasurer's Office brought this bill to clarify that credit unions who are not accepting public deposits over $100,000 do not have to have these custodian relationships. And we did review the amendments. The Treasurer's Office was kind enough to share it with us, the banker's amendments, and our attorney reviewed it, and we're fine with them.
Okay.
That's all I have.
Any questions? Thank you, Pam.
Thanks.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2033? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2033 and open work session. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2033.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2033. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, Dash 1s are adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2033 to the floor, as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2033 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, please call the roll.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Chocolate.
Aye.
Representative
Steele.
Aye.
Representative
Bessel.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Kitts will carry the bill on the floor.
Mr. Chairman, not going to get me. It's not that early. Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2033 be placed on the consent calendar out of fear of having to explain it on the floor.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2033 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, that's too late.
Well, we have Mac. Do we matter?
That's right.
That's over the Mac.
I see. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2034. Janet, please.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This is the second bill introduced at the request of the state treasurer, and I understand it was introduced by them at the request of the banking community. And it also has been through the Revenue Committee, so this is its second committee in the House, and it did pass. You have at your place the staff measure summary from the Revenue Committee, and it did pass from Revenue unanimously. There are no amendments to this bill. Mr. Chair, it enables public funds to be deposited into certificates of deposit in amounts exceeding the $100,000 FDIC limit, but it retains FDIC coverage for the entire deposit by allowing them to split the deposits. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the Treasurer's Office and the Banking Association are here to discuss.
Darren Bond, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. The Treasurer brings you House Bill 2034 at the request of the local banking community. Under current law, any public funds deposits that exceeds federal or private deposit insurance limits must be collateralized. This means that securities must be pledged and deposited with a custodian to provide collateral for the deposit, and as a consequence reduces the funds available for the bank to use to make loans. House Bill 2034 will enable public funds to be deposited into certificates of deposits in amounts exceeding the $100,000 FDIC insurance limits, but retain FDIC insurance for the entire deposit. This eliminates the need for the bank to collateralize the deposits, and it protects the public funds because they're fully insured against loss. I'll let our banking industry experts speak to the mechanics of the program, but in essence, it allows a single large deposit to be made at a local bank, and for that deposit to be turned into multiple FDIC-insured deposits at participating institutions around the country. In return for placing these deposits at other institutions, the local bank gets a like amount of deposits in return. Because none of these deposits exceed the FDIC limit, the entire amount of the deposit is available for use locally and has the benefit of the security of FDIC insurance. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
And so how this works is if the public entity deposits $1 million within one facility, within one commercial bank, then they split that up nine ways or ten ways. They probably retain $100,000 themselves, which would be covered by FDIC. The other nine would go out to other institutions around the country that are also covered by FDIC. So they're insured at that level. And then part of the deal is in that they get $900,000 back from these other institutions for deposit within their bank.
Mr. Chair, that's absolutely correct.
Thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you. Could I have Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman, please?
For clarification, I hope, huh?
The chair has clarified it for us.
Yes, he has.
Ken did such a great job in 2033.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez again. If it's okay, I've advised Council Sherman that he may sit in the back for this particular bill. but both Mr. Bond from the Treasurer's Office and the Chair did a great job explaining the bill. We found ourselves last fall getting ready to have this bill LC'd, and in a conversation with the Treasurer's Office, they said they'd already done that. We said, great, we'll just support your bill when it's introduced, and that's what we're here to do. Banks around the state, like Columbia Community Bank in Hillsborough, is very anxious to use this program. I know there's banks on the coast that are anxious to use it, and it will be a great tool for Oregon's community banks.
Thank you, Tim. And this is not to do with this, but I remember back in the early 80s when interest rates were going out through the ceiling, and savings and loans institutions around the country were desperately looking for deposits to cover some bad loans that they had, and they had low interest loans, and with the interest rates so high, and so we, as a bank, would sell our deposits around the nation to savings and loans up to the $100,000 limit because they were covered, and then we could get that 14-15% interest rate without any of the hazards you have in making loans.
Mr. Chair, so that like kind of practice. CDRS program back before there was a CDRS.
Is there any questions, Tim? Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2034? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2034 and open a work session on House Bill 2034.
You want to take it on? Want to move this on?
Yeah. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I recommend that we move House Bill 2034 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2034 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Shields.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm going to vote for this bill in committee, but I just wanted to reserve the right to look into it more and vote no on the floor.
So noted. Is there any other discussion? Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitts.
Aye.
Representative Trotler.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative Escobar.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Do we have a carrier?
I'll carry it.
Representative Esquivel will carry on the floor.
I heard it here, so maybe I
know. Got it down pat.
It's like deja vu on these last two bills.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2632. Janet, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2362 is introduced by the Judiciary Committee at the request of the Oregon Bankers Association. This bill has not been through the Revenue Committee. Mr. Chair, payment of beneficiaries under a specific monetary bequest in a will is delayed for over a year. Oregon law requires payment of interest to the beneficiary. The rate of interest is set in statute at 5% a year, but since such funds are invested in short-term investments, they may not generate the 5% a year. If the rate cannot be met, the interest must be paid by the rest of the estate. The bill would change the interest rate on specific monetary bequests under a will from 5% a year to the discount rate, defined as the average auction rate on 91-day Treasury bills. Mr. Chair, the bill does have an emergency clause and would take effect July 1st, 2005.
And the answer to your email is pertaining to many money and involving money penalty or fine.
Okay, you get the prize.
Could I have Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman, please? I can't pronounce it when I looked up the meaning.
I have to take.
Is he going to clarify again?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, once again, Tim Martinez on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. To my right, Ken Sherman, Jr., counsel to the Oregon Bankers Association. I'll take a brief layman's explanation before I turn it over to Ken. I think the committee administrator did a great job explaining it, and the key point I want to make is this: the change in this rate is not any dollars, any bank dollars. These are the dollars that are in the trust. And what we've seen happen over time is because of the restrictions on where these dollars can be placed, if the funds are not paid out within that year, by the time they are paid out, the owner of the funds is having to draw into their own dollars, their own funds, to make up that 5% interest. So all this does is allow the rate to float, and it will not, it does not affect. It's not coming. The bank is not making any more. The trust company is not making any additional profit or any additional dollars on these situations. So with that, I'll turn it over for hopefully some brief remarks by Mr. Sherman.
Morning, Ken.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sherman, counsel for the Oregon Bankers. Tim only invites me up here when we have a $4 word like pecuniary to deal with.
I got the meaning.
Right there. This is a bill that will affect primarily individuals who act as personal representatives in estates. Banks also do that, banks that have trust departments, but in my experience, and I have a fairly extensive estate administration practice, most of the PRs out there are individuals. And what happens is you've got an estate, usually it's a sizable estate, and it just takes more than a year to complete the administration of the estate and get your devises or your bequests paid out to the beneficiaries. Right now we have an artificially high rate set in the statute that is to be paid out of the residual part of the estate as interest to those specific receipts or beneficiaries of specific bequests, and this would simply take that rate down to a market rate, which is tied to treasuries. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? And so what the 5% rate is what the trust earns, or what it's charged for their expenses?
Mr. Chairman, this bill has nothing to do with trust. It has to do with probate estates. When grandma dies and you're handling her affairs and going through that probate process, that's where this statute comes into play. And you've got generally speaking, two kinds of people who receive benefits from an estate. You've got people who receive specific amounts of property or money. I leave $100,000 to Uncle Fred. And then you've got what we call the residual beneficiaries, which are the people that get everything that's left after the specific bequests have been paid out. So you take care of the Uncle Freds, and that's the one we're focusing on here. Where the estate process takes more than a year, the law says Fred doesn't just get the $100,000, he also gets 5% interest on that. This would say that interest rate is going to be tied to the market rate. So it's going to float up and down depending on what treasuries are doing at any particular time. Where does that 5% come from? It comes out of the residual part of the estate. So you're robbing these folks over here of an artificially high rate under the current law to pay Fred.
Oh, okay. All right, so they had to pay for Uncle Fred getting more money.
That's right.
Okay.
Uncle Fred liked it, but the rest of the family was upset.
Any other questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2632 and open a work session on House Bill 2632. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend that we send House Bill 2632 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2632 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative
King. Aye.
Representative
Chalker.
Aye.
Representative Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Esquivel. Aye.
Representative
Gilman. Aye.
Representative
O'Holby.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Who wants the one to carry
it? Okay. Consent. Representative Getz.
I think it's bill consent.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Okay. Representative Getz moves we place House Bill 2632 on the consent calendar. Is there any objections? Seeing none, it's done. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2633. Janet.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2633 was also introduced by the Judiciary Committee at the request of the Oregon Bankers Association. It replaces an incorrect reference to trusts in a statute regarding compensation for probate proceedings. Mr. Chair, it might have been a result of a change quite a while ago. The bill used to say discharge of performance of duties as a personal representative, and instead they changed the wording. May have been an inappropriate reference to begin with, but when they changed, they took out gender references in a bill that took out a lot of gender references in statute. Instead of his trust, it was changed to a trust, and that the trust may have had a different connotation when it said his trust. And so that could have been where it originated. Regardless of where it originated, it's incorrect now, and the bill just removes that statement and changes it to performance of duties of a personal representative instead of talking about the trust. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Going to have Tim Martinez and Ken Sherman again, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, still Tim Martinez for the Oregon Banking Association. The committee administrator obviously did her homework. We think in one of the cleanup bills, maybe 10 or 12 years ago when they did make the gender changes, this change was made. I guess at one level we apologize for not catching it sooner, but as it reads right now in current law, it really makes no sense because this section is talking about a personal representative, and then to turn around and talk about the discharge of a trust, really, there's no logic to that. So we are simply changing discharge of a trust to performance of duties as a personal representative, which is what the sentence talks about. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Sherman, who I know will be extremely brief at this particular moment.
Mr. Chairman, I have nothing to add.
Any questions, please? I don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. With that, I'll close the public hearing. Let's see, was there anyone else here that wanted to testify on House Bill 2633? And then we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2633 and open the work session on 2633. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, I move that we send House Bill 2633 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2633 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, please call the roll.
Representative
Shawker. Aye.
Representative
Fields.
Aye.
Representative
Bielke. Aye.
Representative
Colby.
Aye.
Representative
Fish.
Aye.
Chair Brady. Aye. Motion carries. House, put on the consent calendar.
Number to make a motion.
Yeah, Representative Esquivel moves House.
Yeah, go ahead.
House Bill 2633 be placed on the consent calendar. Any objections? Seeing none. Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2637. Yeah, Janet, please.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2637 is at the request of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, and it specifies that mortgage lenders' surety bonds and letters of credit are accessible only to consumers by limiting the right of action against the surety to signers of the mortgage application. Mr. Chair, it also deletes criminal penalties for violating loan originator continuing education requirements and requires the Department of Consumer and Business Services to certify organizations that give exams, the loan originator continuing education and exams, and that they be given, the exams be given in secure locations. That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Janet. Can I have John McCulley and Joe Camarena? Did I get that close?
That's correct.
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm not Tim Martinez. Don McCulley, representing the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, here to urge your support for House Bill 2637. I want to just quickly describe the bill, although I think your committee administrator did a fine job in doing that. I hate to call a bill a housekeeping measure, but largely that's what House Bill 2637 is. There are three parts to the bill. The first part corrects what we think is a mistake that the Oregon Supreme Court made last June when they ruled in a case involving the mortgage lender bond that's required that anybody could have access to that bond. And we had intended when this law was first passed in 1993 that that bond was in place to protect consumers. The court broadened that so that commercial interests could also access the bond. This happened, like I say, in June of 2004. It was past the time when the Department of Consumer and Business Services had to get their bills in or a request to the governor. So we agreed that we would include this in our package of legislation to make that correction in the bill. And so now the bill would specify that the consumer is the one who has access to the bond. The second part of the bill relates to the education requirements for loan originators. This was based on legislation passed in 2001 that requires every loan originator, these are the people who have direct contact with the consumers in discussing the terms and conditions of the loan, it requires them to have continuing education of 20 hours every 2 years. There was an oversight in passing that, in that if a person fails to get that 20 hours of continuing education, they would be subject to a Class C felony. It seems a little harsh to have someone subject to a felony just for not getting their continuing education. So this bill corrects that by including it as part of the civil penalties that could be levied by DCBS for a person who didn't complete their continuing education. The third part of the bill relates again to the education part of this profession. It clarifies how the examinations are given for people who enter this profession. Again, in 2001, we established that a person becoming a loan originator had to take classes and then pass an examination on the laws and rules that exist to protect consumers. We have since that time discovered in this process that there needs to be some tightening of the rules. Under the current system, the classes are done primarily online. We have heard of instances where one person in an office may take the exam and he may or she may take it for everybody else in the office. We have understood there are circumstances where loan originators are sharing the answers to the tests. And so this bill would specify that that test be given by an organization that has experience in providing these types of tests, and secondly, that the test be given at a secure location. We understand, for example, now that many professions require that there be a secure location for the test. Sylvan Learning Center, for example, I think that's where securities people go for their examinations. Late last Friday, Mr. Chair, I had understood that we had no problems with this bill, and late last Friday we got a call from DCBS that they were concerned about the specific language regarding who gives the examination. And that language in your bill, just so you can note it, is on page 2, the new language added at line, starting at line 28. After our meeting last Friday, we agreed on some language to clarify how the director can have a better control over the people who are providing these examinations. The director was concerned that by using the language may not, that really hamstrung them on administering this part of the bill. So we are taking some language down to legislative council to clarify that, and hopefully can bring the back to you, bill back to you with that clarification made. Mr. Chair, I'm still not aware of anybody who's opposed to the bill, but this is one little bump in the road that we need to take care of to make sure that the regulator can properly administer the legislation. I'd be happy to answer any question. I brought Joe Camarena, who is the president of the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals, with me for any technical issues we may confront here.
Representative Kitts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, you partially addressed my question in your last statements, but in reading the language, I guess it doesn't specifically answer my question. Who currently could administer this test as of right now, and that's part one. Part two of that would be, if this passes, who then could administer the test?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, right now the test can be administered by anyone. And normally it's administered by the organization that may be providing the training.
Okay.
So they provide the training and then they provide the test online, and there are several groups that are doing that training. If this bill were to pass, those organizations could still provide the training, provided they have expertise in doing professional testing, or a third party could come in and develop a test specifically for loan originators, and then they could offer the test. So there are two different options if this bill were to pass.
In the definition, who would determine what you just said, the expertise, they must show expertise in the area. Who would determine that? Would that be the director of the DCBS? Would that be the head of the organization? Who would determine that criteria?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, ultimately it's the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services through their Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is the regulator for this.
Okay. One more follow-up. If this bill passes and that window goes, or you know, that it funnels down to just the very few people that can administer the test, will there be a fee to that? And is there currently a fee?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, there is a fee for taking the course right now, which includes the test. I would guess that there would still be that fee there if the provider of the test is also the one who's qualified to admit, who provides the course, is also going to give the test. There would probably be a fee with that. If there is an independent third party, my guess is yes, there would be a fee associated with that as well.
Thank you.
Janet's got a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. John, is the test given just at entry, or is the test given after each continuing education requirement?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Atkins, the test is given at entry level. That's the hurdle that the prospective loan originator must scale to be able to enter the profession.
Okay.
Normally there are, under the continuing education, there may be various opportunities to test knowledge, but it's not required as it is in the statute to be able to do this work.
John, if the bond is there to intended to protect consumers and not commercial interests, couldn't a commercial interest be a consumer also?
Mr. Chair, I suppose that could be the way the bill is written. It's the person who signs the loan documents. Okay, so that might be a commercial interest in a commercial transaction. I'm looking to my president here in case I'm stepping out, but I think that is possible, but it is the consumer, the person who has the direct relationship with the broker.
And so with this change, it wouldn't preclude that entity from accessing the bond too if there was a problem.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. If that is the person who signs the loan application.
Okay. Any other questions? John? Representative Holby.
Thank you. I'm sorry I stepped out for a few minutes, but Representative Kitts touched on something that just kind of made me think. Is there anything in the statute, or is there any need to have anything in statute that authorizes your ability to have a fee for the testing? Or is that entirely regulated by administrative rule by DCBS?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I believe DCBS has that authority now to establish rules to not only operate this program, but including any fees that would be charged.
Thank you.
And Joe, go ahead. You have testimony, too, via introduction.
No, I just wanted to reconfirm what our lobbyist, John McCauley, indicated, Mr. Chair, that on that bond it is directly the consumer. So if there was a commercial incident, it would have to be the consumer. The consumer would take effect if that person signed that loan application. So that's a really critical point.
Thank you. Representative Schaffer.
I know we've. This is off the focus of what we're trying to do here, but we're not raising any fees with this bill, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schaffler, no, we are not raising fees with this
Thank
bill.
Thank you very much.
Representative Kidd.
Clarification, that's not entirely accurate, is it? Because the fee could be raised by DCBS at any point in time they so chose. If this bill passes, they could choose to raise the fee based on the incurred administrative cost as they see fit. Is that correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, that's correct, but they, in absence of this bill, they could do that as well.
Sure. So.
Thank you. Any other questions? Don't say any. Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on House Bill 2637? Seeing none. We have some amendments coming, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2637. And
we do have amendments now.
We have any amendments here?
No.
Going to open a public hearing on House Bill 24, or work session on House Bill 2461. Janet, can you tell us what the bill does and what the amendments are?
Mr. Chair, speaking of fees, this bill had a couple of had a hearing on March 2nd. It's the bill that would require applicants for new commissions as public notaries to complete a three-hour education course on the laws, rules, practices, and procedures relating to notaries. Specifies that notaries that apply for renewal are not required to take the course. It's just new notaries. And it requires the Secretary of State to offer a course and to certify providers of courses. The fee was $5 for the to cover the cost of the new requirement and the new training. But the Dash 1 amendments at your place today delete the new $5 fee. And that was at the request of the chair that those amendments be drafted. The bill does have a referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and intention is to maintain that referral to the Ways and Means Committee. And if you have any questions about the requirement, Jan Coleman from Yamhill County is here.
From Yamhill County. Anyone here want to testify on what was the bill now? 2461 or the Dash 1 amendments? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, just a reminder that it's currently there's a $20 charge for. And this would the $5 is going to be an addition of that $20.
And that's a renewable fee, and never
right.
So many years. Yeah. Okay. The chair would entertain a motion.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to 2461.
Representative Gilman moves the Dash 1 amendments to 2461. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
I have one question. I'm sorry. I apologize. I had to step out. We've removed the fee.
The $5 fee.
Increase?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Is there any other questions? The Dash 1 amendments to 2461 are adopted.
I'm glad to see that you're so fiscally responsible.
Mr. Chair, I have a question of Janet. Mm-hmm. Janet, do you say it still has to go to Ways and Means?
Mr. Chair and Representative Gilman, the discussion was that since it could have a small effect on the Secretary of State's budget and we aren't giving them the okay. additional fee, it may be okay. something that they want to discuss when they discuss their budget in Ways and Means.
Okay.
Well, I got it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move we refer 2461 as amended to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gilman moves that we send House Bill 2461 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Representative Kitts.
What, now, Janet, maybe you could, I was asking Representative Schaffler a question. Why would it go to Ways and Means if we're sending the $5 fee and there's no change? There's currently a $20 fee. There's always been a $20 fee.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, because you aren't increasing the fee, but you are putting a requirement on, it could be something that the Ways and Means Committee, when they're discussing the Secretary of State's budget, should be aware of.
Okay. Secretary of State,
increasing their requirement.
People might come in and want more money to administer the test.
Ah. I think, may I, Mr. Chair?
Certainly, Representative Schaffler.
All them liberals on Ways and Means might want to increase the fees.
God bless. Is there any other discussion? Seeing none, Katie, will you call the roll, please?
Aye.
Uncontrollable.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Kitt.
No.
Representative Schaffler.
A liberal aye. Aye. Motion carries. And with that, committee, is there anything else, Jim?
You're fine. I love you, babe.
Wednesday morning, 8 o'clock.
Wednesday morning, 8 o'clock.
What you talking about, Janet? Open them sleepy eyes.
Is there anything else? If not, we are adjourned.
What is on at 8 o'clock?
What are the meeting?
Who's carrying that? We didn't. Oh, we, no, we're not moving that one to the floor.
We don't
want
keep us on our toes.
Keep carrying it if you like.
No, it's George's bill. I don't want to carry it.
I don't need to pay the fee.
Why don't you carry it over to Ways and Means?
Okay, I'll carry it.
Is it your bill?
My bill.
Might have voted no.
Is that why Kit voted no?
Probably the reason.
$5 for the bottle to come in 15 minutes late.
You're selling for $5 for 15 minutes. You can buy your way out of the class.
Well, is this a new educational requirement that the Secretary of State has to oversee?
Yes.
That's why.
You don't have to. So you missed floor session. You shouldn't have
that.
There is.
You've got unemployment insurance.
Money.